Alan Kring Productions in association with Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 4, delivered on August 29th.
Today, financial institution types. Before that, I begin with the screens just to have a look. Sir, is this a good day or a bad day? Who's winning on the street today? The what? The Bulls. Bulls are the big dogs, and this is a strong bull day. You have markets, the S&P 500 and the Dow up a percent and a quarter. The NASDAQ almost 1.5%. It is a very significant day on the street, but then again, that doesn't mean that everything is fine now. A bear would say, this is the calm before the storm. The bear would say, you are being suckered into a position here where we're just going to take you to the cleaners in shorts when the crash happens. And the crash is going to happen. I just finished in my 341 corporate finance class showing them how grim it is. The signals that we watch are showing things that we haven't ever seen before as far as how bad it is. That's a bear market. However, I am not the kind of professor who wants you to take my word for it. You have to form your own opinion. And in some cases, I have to allow someone who disagrees with me to, hang on here, let me check. I have a guest who is very bullish on the market, and I want you to hear from that person.
Hi, I'm a bull. That's right, a bull who talks. And I believe that this is a bull market. There is never going to be a down. The sky is the limit. No one is ever going to stop this market. In fact, there really isn't such a thing as a bear. I mean, bears are a myth. This is a glorious day and a glorious investment period for you and everyone else. Don't believe that there is such a thing as a bear because bears don't exist, ever. They've never, Mo?
No!
No, not the sting, not the E1 sting, so no, 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 no!
Cutting that off. Moving along.
Financial institutions. Have you ever written a check?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I used to go out with a Czechoslovakian girl, but she, my parents said they don't accept checks. It doesn't get better than this, bro. Okay, let it ride. Okay. Now, a check at a bank arises from something called a demand deposit. A demand deposit is a very special kind of deposit because a person who has a check written against a demand deposit can go in and say, I demand this money, and that has to be given to them, him or her, right away. So I write you a check. You can walk to my bank and say, with proper credentials, I demand this money now. That's why we call it a demand deposit. It is highly, highly liquid. And demand deposits are actually provided only by banks. Financial institutions, the first one would be something like a retail bank. Now, I'm going to caution you. The book kind of draws bright lines, and there are a lot of them the book lists. And these are a little bit fuzzy anymore, and I'll explain why in a while. But a demand deposit represents a liability to the bank. This is as close to accounting as I try to get in this class. So you deposit $100 at a bank. So what happens is that as far as the bank goes, cash debits $100. And on the, this is an asset. On the liability side, the demand deposits get credited $100. See that matching thing that they're all, accounting is really, really into the matching thing. Okay, so now, the bank has this $100 in its assets. So what's the next thing that the bank is going to do is that it is going to lend that money, or at least part of that money, out. Let's say it lends it all out. So at that point, what happens is that the bank then moves that as an asset in cash, $100, and then debits $100 to an asset called its loans. And then so essentially the bank is building a portfolio that has loans as its dominant resource. Now, interestingly enough, on this whole thing here, generally speaking, a little background. Sometimes when students say, I need a job, a finance student, so I need a job, and I'm having a hard time, what I'll do is I will send them with the recommendation to the comptroller of the currency or the treasury or the Fed or the FDIC. They have audit teams all over the country, regional audit teams. And these teams go out and they go to banks and they look at the quality of their assets to see if the bank is secure and sound. So they would look, if you got into one of those audit teams, and there are several around here, and my former students are in three of them, they would look at these loans against the liability of the demand deposit. Now, they need to keep their investors, their depositors, I should say, money is safe. So they have to look at the loans to make sure that those loans are, that portfolio of assets, which is their loans, has a certain quality to it. For one thing, they don't want them putting loans into risky things. Like, for example, down here, one of the leaders who had done a hiring for me twice now, she was explaining that one thing they see is sometimes these banks in this area, not very experienced in the ways of the world, they'll have these people from Chicago come down here and say, we're giving you a chance to provide us loans for this high-rise luxury apartment complex in Chicago. And sometimes they'll be suckered into this high-risk loan to some players from Chicago. And so they say, okay, those are risky, and that's part of your portfolio, and that is causing the liability you have to your depositors to be at risk because of this. That's one way thing they'll say is, okay, you need to get this, not do this, and you need to find a way to get this off your books. Another thing that they'll look for is how concentrated the portfolio is. You see, she was one who was telling me that they find some banks and pretty much all of their loans are to farmers for farm equipment or for more land or something like that. That's not a good idea, too, because that means that if the farm sector slides, then that portfolio has a lot of exposure to that same, to that risk. So they like to see a nice balance, home loans, maybe a few commercial business loans, maybe some of those, maybe some farm loans, so that the risk is more spread out. And again, that gives some better protection to the liabilities they have to the depositors in those accounts. So, and this is as far as I go with doing accounting in here. I should probably wash my hands before I go any further, but anyway. So now, when I talk about a bank, a traditional bank, B-A-N-K, not a B-A-N-C, by the way, a B-A-N-K, they are the ones that do things like demand deposits. Checking accounts. In other words, checking accounts. And they do other things too. Now, in recent years, the banks have gotten involved in more than a single thing. So the lines that your book, it's fine that they do it because you need clear boundaries to learn it. But in the real world, there's a lot of area that's hazy and fuzzy. And I'll talk a little more about that in a minute. This is a high liquidity thing. Now, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to talk more about this, but I'm going to bring it up right here now, is that different assets have different liquidities, obviously. Now, start out as our metrics go, measuring liquidity of assets. We talk about the first one being M0. That is just the base currency and cash. Now, hardly ever do you actually hear M0 reported. I keep an eye on it because it's just how much actual physical coin and currency there is in the economy flying around, moving from back and forth. Now, the first one that most economists, finance people, and others politicians would talk about is M1. The Federal Reserve measures this one. This is M0. Plus demand deposits. So this is still very liquid. Now, interestingly enough, there's another thing in M1 that they count. Historically, it was kind of important, but anymore, hardly anyone uses it. Have any of you ever used traveler's checks? Have you heard of them? At one time, they were really big. Don't leave home without them. They were essentially just as good as money. Anywhere in the world, traveler's checks worked. You wouldn't carry American dollars. You'd carry traveler's checks. The nice thing about them was they were insured. So if you lost them or they were stolen, traveler's checks company would reimburse you. So this is in there, but, I mean, it's so not used anymore. But at one time, there was enough of it out there that it counted for something. Anyway, M1 is highly liquid. The next level up is M2. Now, M2 is M1. It has everything that M1 does, which has everything that M0 has. Plus, now accounts. Now this takes us to the next one. Now accounts. Credit unions do not issue checks. Wait a minute, I've got checks for my credit union. Are any of you in a credit union? Any of you at all? ISU Credit Union? Yeah, you are? Okay, and they gave you checks, right? Or something like that. Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, credit unions call them checks, but they're actually NOW accounts. NOW stands for Negotiable Order of Withdrawal. Negotiable Order of Withdrawal. Now, I don't think they require it anymore, but it used to be that they couldn't spell it C-H-E-C-K. They had to spell it C-H-E-Q-U-E to distinguish it from a true bank check. The difference is that if I write you a check, you can walk to my bank, and I've got a bank account. You can walk to my bank, I've got a $100 check, here's my ID, give me the money. The bank has to. With a NOW account, I write you a check for my credit union, you take it to the bank. Technically, the credit union does not have to give you the $100 right away. It could say, okay, please come back in 30 days and we'll give you your money. They will not do this. I promise you they will avoid doing that at any possible time. But technically, it is not as liquid. In other words, efficiently transactable as a check is. So M2 has the NOW accounts in it because they are not technically as liquid. It also has M2 small time deposits. In other words, you know, little certificates of deposit, CDs, 1 year or less. You have to keep it in there for a year or you get a penalty for early withdrawal. Okay, now the last one is M3. This is M2 plus large time deposits. And when I say large, I'm talking about CDs in the tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. Large time deposits. In other words, you can't get that money, and it's big money for a long time. 3 years, 5 years, maybe something like that in these CDs. And it has the 800-pound gorilla, the euro dollars. Now, to repeat what I had said earlier, a euro dollar is a U.S. dollar that is in the foreign reserves of another country's central bank. A euro dollar is a U.S. dollar that is in the foreign reserves of the central bank of another country. A euro dollar is a U.S. dollar that is in the foreign reserves of the central bank of another country. The Chinese have trillions of these. The Japanese, the Arabs, the Canadians, South Americans. You see, well, how did they get all those dollars? The euro is just, you know, another country. They could be in any central bank. Well, how did they get all those dollars? Well, here's how it works. Here is the United States. And here, for example, is China. Now, what we're going to do here is talk, first of all, about what is called the current account. This is the trade balance you might have heard about. Well, the trade balance is, this is the trade balance. The technical name for it is the current account. You see, you, madam, decide you want to buy a Japanese car. You want to buy one for $20,000, okay, for $2,000. Okay, let's say it's a nice one. It's a $15,000 Japanese car. Well, what will happen there? Well, let's say it's a Chinese car. Okay, China will sell us stuff. And in exchange, we will sell them U.S. dollars in a mirroring transaction. The balance is a trade surplus, or whoever is getting more money. If we sell something to China, we get yuan. If they sell something to us, they get dollars. The balance of trade is which one is getting more of the others. But anyway, now, again, a Chinese merchant does not get our dollars. We'll never see them. They go directly to the People's Bank of China, their central bank, which then puts them in its vault and gives the merchant the equivalent in the Chinese currency, the yuan. Again, you bought that car for $15,000. So the car comes to you, the stuff. The $15,000 goes to the People's Bank of China. And then the People's Bank of China gives the auto manufacturer the equivalent in yuan. The Chinese have long played the game that they would give their merchants a lot of yuan for those dollars, which gave the Chinese the incentive to charge low prices because they were getting a lot of yuan for them, which is why we knew they were doing it. We let other countries do it for almost a century. But anyway, okay, that is the current account. That's how they get those euro dollars, stacked up by the trillions in countries from which we buy cheap toasters, cars, oil, French wine, you name it. That's how those countries accumulated all of those euro dollars. Now, they can't spend those anywhere but in the United States. You can't spend a currency of a country except in that country, unless there's some kind of special arrangement. So, what does China do with all of its euro dollars? Well, it just does this. We have the mirror image called the capital account. The capital account is when those euro dollars flow back here. China, okay, last week our U.S. government had to borrow money to pay for $1 trillion that it just doesn't have. We've cut taxes so much, we have spent so much on defense, you can't even make a joke of a comparison. You could cut every welfare program out completely, and you wouldn't even dent that $1 trillion our government needed. Well, who's going to do that? Well, the Treasury goes out and it sells Treasury paper. In other words, it borrows money. Who has the money? Those Chinese, Japanese, Arabs, Canadians, Scandinavians, Europeans. And they will then flow those euro dollars back here to us to pay for our excessive lifestyle, low taxes, borrow until the sun goes down on new homes, new furniture, new cars, new computers, and all that, because we can't live within our means. We just cannot. And what we do in exchange, well, what's the exchange here? Oh, that was easy. That's you. We're selling them your asses. See, because sooner or later we have to pay them back. We pay the interest on those loans, and eventually we pay the maturity value of them. So that's where we commit you, to future expected cash flows. Of United States citizens. That's you. We're putting you on the hook to pay this back down the road. We get money right now to live beyond our means, and then you will have to pay it back with interest in 5, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 years, all of that is on you. Well, that's not much of a problem. That sounds like a pretty good deal. Ask the protesters in Hong Kong what they think of being under the thumb of the communist Chinese. Ask Khashoggi what he thinks of being under the thumb of the Saudis. Oh, that's right, he was butchered by the crown prince. Ask yourself what it feels like that you are the bitches of foreign countries that, as bad as you've heard about the United States, and a lot of it's true, those cats are a hell of a lot worse, and it's you that we have committed to paying them back just because we couldn't stand it. We had to have stuff instead of staying in our bill, paying our bills. Now, if that doesn't disturb you, I got some other stuff to show you that will really upset you. Matter of fact, when I do the Federal Reserve, I'm going to show you something about this that is going to turn you into a bunch of raving conspiracy theorists. Now that I've brightened your days, okay, this whole process here, look. Remember I talked about deficit economic units, those who need money, and surplus economic units, those who have money, and the financial intermediaries. Who do the financial intermediation, matching those who need money with those who have money, based upon level, timing, and risk from the last lecture. This is the job of the financial institutions. The surplus units bring it in, put money into the financial intermediaries, which then deliver it out to those who need it. Businesses, households, people, all kinds of animals. And all these different ones. Retail banks and credit unions are mostly consumer directed. Those are the kind you would see, you would know the names, and you might even do business with them. Now, interestingly enough, and I'll bring this up because I use the term too, the commercial banks. Now, commercial banks are sort of like ginormous department stores. They're like everything under one roof. You want a checking account. You want a savings account. You want this. You want that. You want a loan for a home. You want a loan for a motorcycle. You want a... They kind of are one stops. These are those too big to fail banks. The Wells Fargo, the Citibanks, the other behemoths of the earth. But honestly, it's like retail banks do a lot of this themselves. It's more along the line of a retail bank would be something like a department store as opposed to a Walmart. At the department store, at Target, you can get a lot of things, but there's still stuff that you can't get there that you can get at Meijer or Walmart or something like that. So the commercial banks are just sort of like bloated examples of these things. Now, as I go down this list, and just about everything. Now, as I go down this list, I want to predicate this. This happened right about when you were born. Okay, now, in the 1920s, there was so much nonsense, awful stuff going on in banking, in stocks and bonds, in labor, you name it. I mean, it was just a heyday of free market, laissez-faire, leave it alone kind of markets. The best government is no government regulation. And of course, we had the crash of 29, and then we teetered into the Great Depression, and all of those free marketers were kicked out, and hardcore reformers, from the president to the representatives of the senators, came in, and they were going to crack down on all of it. They hit it hard in securities law, in labor law, in banking. Now, the banking fist came in the form of a law that was called Glass-Steagall. You don't have to write that down. I'm going to bring it up later more formally. But the Glass-Steagall Act really put hard limits and walls on what banks could do. And, I mean, it was just, no, bank, you can't sell stocks. No, brokerage house, you can't sell investment scams. It was just all over the place. And to some extent, it's folded in with securities laws that were passed to form this wall of separation of different types of financial services so that they couldn't play games. You couldn't go to a bank that had just done a public offering for a company that could then sucker you into buying the stock. Things like that. No bank, you can't offer insurance. In 1999, the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed. It was upon agreement of a right-wing conservative House of Representatives and Senate and a neoliberal president named Bill Clinton that Glass-Steagall was ended. Because the bank said, oh, you don't need to worry, we're mature, we're never going to do anything wrong again. Come on, take these shackles off us. And so they did. And hence we had the crash of 2008. And then everyone found Jesus and said, well, we won't do that stuff. Well, now it's about 10 times as bad as it was before the 2008 catastrophe. And we're walking right into it again because we can't have the guts to reform and bring back Glass-Steagall and make it even harder than it was before. So these things that I'm telling you about, a lot of them would have been illegal 20 years ago when Glass-Steagall was in effect. Now, free markets, self-regulation, the industry can police its own. Yeah, okay, now, let's go on here. Another place. You could see, investment banks. Now, these are banks that buy the stock and bonds of public offerings. So I'm an investment bank. You want to sell $500 million worth of stock. Well, what I do is I buy that stock, primary market transaction, and then I sell it to my best clients. You who provided me the money to do it, and then we pump the stock up, we sell it to you suckers, and the price goes down. Life is like that. That's an investment bank, primarily dealing in stocks, primary offerings. Okay? Now, here's some other things that are odd. You don't exactly think of them as financial intermediaries, but pension funds. Pension funds have scads of money coming in every month. I put money into a pension fund. That's got to go somewhere. So a surplus economic unit, me, gives the money to the pension fund, which then has to do something with it. Typically, they have to invest in very safe stuff. Very safe. So that would be, in other words, you would see pension funds investing in government treasury paper, AAA corporate bonds, stuff like that. They can't invest in risky stuff, which is why we have a billowing pension fund crisis in this country. Illinois is very well known for having a ridiculously underfunded pension plan for me. But, I mean, it's all over. Many states and a lot of private pension plans. They're not talking about it yet, but mark my word, 10 years from now, there's a pension crisis all over the country. Well, we know there is now. You see, the problem is that they defined the benefits of the retirees, assuming that the pension funds would earn maybe about 8%. But because rules of pension funds require that they invest only in very safe stuff doesn't pay 8%. It pays 3%, if that. Which means that all of these decades, those pension funds were promising pension benefits that would have been the accumulation of 8% over 40 years of a work life, but they were earning only 3% over those 40 years in the pension fund investments. That's the source of the crisis. And it is going to be one hell of a thing, and we can't borrow our way out of it. There's no way we'll have enough credit left to borrow that kind of money, which some are estimating at $40 to $60 trillion in the hole on the pension funds that are underfunded. $40 to $60 trillion. No, you're not going to borrow that from the Japanese and the Chinese and the Arabs. We're just going to have to tax the crap out of you guys. We're going to just have to raise your taxes. Otherwise, you know what's going to happen? They're going to tell me I can't have my pension check, and I'm going to go to you and beat you with my cane, because you're not going to let them raise your taxes so I can live better. Yeah, and I'm going to live well. I was told in 17 years, if I retire in 17 years, I'm going to get a pension check every month for $118. Let the good times roll. Assholes. Anyway. Pension funds. Okay. Now here's one. This is a ginormous surplus economic unit. Insurance companies. Good grief. They have, this is especially life insurance companies, but it's also P&C, property and casualty. I mean, they're getting life insurance payments in by the, just billions. I'm going to ask you something. Madam, do you know that you are going to die someday? You're going to live a wonderful life, and then you're going to get really sick, and you're going to be in pain, suffering, bitching your head off, and finally you'll shut up and die. Unfortunately, for those of us around you, you will live to about 90, maybe 100 by the time. You're going to live a long time. You're a male, 70, 80, okay? Mercifully die 20 years before she does. But, you know, if I'm going to be in a life insurance company collecting your collecting your premiums, I don't want that money back for decades. I want to put it into things that are very long term so that I don't have to worry about rolling it over. That means that these life insurance companies are going to have to, they will buy long-term bonds, government bonds, high-grade corporate bonds, AAAs, AAs. They'll put the money into those because those are very long-term. And that's where you get the one of the biggest resources, one of the biggest resources for certain types of deficit economic units to get their money, corporations and things like that, even home loans to a certain extent, but not really. Now, property and casualty companies. Now, a lot of their premiums, they're going to have to pay out within a year, 2 years, little car accidents, sicknesses and all that. However, there is a lot of it that they don't want that money back. Those property and casualty companies do not want their money back from those they provided to for a long, long time. Think about this. Did you know, sir, that we live right now, we are near a horrifically dangerous fault line? It is called the New Madrid, and it's east of here. Now, the New Madrid fault line. It looks like it's spelled Madrid, but it's pronounced Madrid. The last time it uncorked was about 200 years ago. Now, I, in fact, when I taught English literature, I read letters to my students of people who had lived in St. Louis in that area at the time. It was literally like reading an apocalyptic novel, a science fiction. The descriptions of the destruction, the smoke, the dead bodies by the thousands, the misery of the survivors. And then the earthquakes kept coming. First aftershocks, and then the New Madrid slipped again 6 weeks after the first time. And it just caused even more destruction. They were starting to rebuild, everything knocked down. And, interestingly enough, this is the story. The story was told that the first one, made the Mississippi River run backward. Actually, it didn't. The shock wave was so powerful, it literally threw the water of the Mississippi back north, and then it came back south as a tidal wave. Just a phenomenal monster, flooding the croplands along the Mississippi River and the Illinois River, wiping out towns along its path back down. There was one writer at the time, he described the night, he said, we heard it coming. He said, I was listening outside and I could hear the voice of the water. It said to me, I'm a coming. And that was it. Killed his family, wiped out all of his crops and his animals. That is how bad the New Madrid can be. The time before that, as best we can tell from Native Americans of the area in their legends, is 500 years ago. So it's 200 to 300 year cycle, possibly. I had a property and casualty insurance type, commercial guy. He was coming and talking about how interesting it was. He was showing this chart, and he said, here's our earthquake coverage. Now, of course, there's very little chance of an earthquake in this part of the country in a given year. We might have a few rumbles, but then he was showing major earthquake, and he was showing the table over the past 20 years of the probability. And every year, the probability of major earthquake category was inching upward. A little by little by little every year. By the time, I think his data was 1917, his last one was, 2018 it was. That probability of New Madrid, and I know darn well that major earthquake in this part of the country, that's New Madrid. It had gotten up to a little more than 1%, if I remember his table right. Well, that's still not bad, but still. You understand, though, that the property and casualty companies, they'll provide earthquake insurance, but they do need to put that into a long-term perspective, into long-term investments, because in any given year, there's an extraordinarily low probability of an earthquake. But over a period of 200 years out here, or a hell of a lot less on the West Coast, well, that's another matter entirely. An interesting story in this regard. The attacks on the United States of 2001 on September the 11th targeted the Pentagon and certain buildings in New York City, the World Trade Center. The first plane did not do a direct hit on the Tower 1. It clipped it and it caused just absolute unbelievable destruction. The second plane slammed dead on into that second tower and just absolutely obliterated it. It was just phenomenal, the destruction. The Twin Towers, only one of them was insured. Only one. Because the probability, you got two skyscrapers together, the probability of one of them falling is ridiculously low. I mean, the probability of both of them dropping, well, you wouldn't even talk about that, but it did. It's like the old story, I may have already mentioned it to you. Picked up this young hitchhiker late one night, young man. He just looked exhausted, and he said, thank God, I mean, no one's picking me up. They think, I'm like a serial killer or something. And I just said to him, What's the probability of two serial killers in the same car? He was so quiet for the rest of that trip. Now, a few other things. Mutual funds. And I've talked about this, and ETFs. They get your money as investments in their funds, and they need to do something with it. ETFs just buy more stock. Mutual funds, they buy stuff too. They are providers to deficit units. Some company needs money for stock that it wants to sell. An ETF will step in there. We'll put you into our portfolio. Here's your money. Mutual funds, the same thing. Now, here's one that's just kind of, this one actually kind of weirded me out. Just 2 days ago, brokerage accounts. Now, I wanted to form a separate, this was 2 days ago. I wanted to form a separate trading account, what we call in my business a side betting account. So I'd have my core, very well-balanced portfolio, the thing that I preach to you. And then I have over here a little account where I make side bets on stocks. Very risky plays. I get a rumor. I check it out as best I can. And if it looks like it's a play, I'll put a couple $100 into it. And so I wanted to do this somewhere other than with where my main money was. It's like the old saying, don't crap in the same room you eat in. So I set it up, and I talked to the young fellow on the phone, very bright, personable. He wasn't quite ready for someone like me. He got quiet a few times. But I set up this nice, you know, just trade, buy stocks, sell stocks, maybe some options. And then he started to market me. And he said, you know, you could really benefit. We can provide you with a checking account. You can what? Yeah. Would you like a checking account? You'll get a debit card with it. I will? Yeah, and it's and then he almost really, he really had me. It's gold colored. Ooh. I don't have a gold colored card. And then this son of a bitch, he goes on, he said, would you like to set up a retirement account? We can set you up an IRA. And, you know, what else are you going to offer me? He said, well, we have a variety of other products. And I'm like, you're offering all these things. You're a brokerage house. I never had any idea that you would do these things, too. And he said, yeah, matter of fact, you know, we also provide auto loans. You what? I mean, did Glass-Steagall... In the Glass-Steagall days, you did that kind of stuff, you would have been taken out and shot, hanged, and then called bad names. But now they can, they're almost like, it was almost like they were talking like a retail bank. A retail bank. So there's that. Now there's one up here I'm going to write. It's an oddball. And I was even offered a very high-paying job at one of these not far from here. And I use the term captive. It's a company that is not anything to do with, well, it might be. It's a company that is not in the business, per se, of financial intermediation, that creates or buys a financial intermediary. Primarily for the purpose of providing the services to its employees. So you can have a very large corporation, and they try to be a one-stop for their employees. Like, for example, there are some of these mega corporations. They've literally got campuses. You can have an apartment, restaurants, daycare, exercise, a movie theater on the campus of these big mega corporations. And they're not that's a model. And some of them are simply creating or buying a captive so that their employees can go to the captive for low-interest home loans, car loans. They can put their money in accounts there for checks and all that. These captive banks are a thing. I mean, State Farm has a captive bank that if you work for State Barn, you get to have a State Barn checking account. They're all, in a way, they're sort of like credit unions. You see, a credit union's unique feature is it's supposed to have a narrow clientele. A credit union cannot just give out accounts to just anybody. They have to be meet some criteria, like ISU Credit Union. You have to be affiliated with ISU or Heartland or something like that. Like credit union, like IAA. The Illinois IAA is a credit union here in town, too, up on Veterans Parkway. You have to be in the Farm Bureau, Growmark, John Deere, country companies, kind of family of companies to be in an account there. So that's credit unions. And these captives seem to have that same aspect. You can't just walk into the State Barn Bank and get an account. You'd have to be an employee, I think. And I've got to be a little careful about that. But it has criteria like credit unions do. But these captives are out there. Now I'm going to tell you about the two evils of the universe, which are financial intermediaries. Hedge funds and private equity firms. These are pretty evil animals. They, if you can get into one as a player, as one of the people who does this, you can make a fortune beyond your wildest dreams. And all you have to do is destroy companies in your path. That's all you have to do. That means destroying companies, destroying lives, breaking up families, causing people to die early because they don't have proper health care. Yeah, that's all you have to do. And I'm not joking about this. Let me give you an idea of, this one will be a private equity firm. True story, real stuff. This private equity firm went to Sears. Now, Sears had been around for a century or more. Sears had been the pioneer of sales of what we would call remote sales. They were the first company to have the idea of sending everyone in the country a catalog. And I'm old enough that I remember the Sears catalog in an outhouse. Because you could read it, and then you could tear out the pages. They were made so you could use them for toilet paper. What we used to call bum fodder. And so, too much sharing, Professor. Sears, the triumph of retail American capitalism, was dying. And why was it dying? Because it would not stay with the times. You ever been into a Sears? Sears still smells like my grandma did 80 years ago. Sears, yea, still selling paisley and gingham dresses with radical show the ankle. That is how old. They were tired. JCPenney had the same problem. They never stayed with the times. The company Sears, which pioneered remote sales, had the skill sets to seize the internet when it began. But they sat on their fat asses and just lived on their reputation, as far too many companies do. We're Sears. We'll never die. So many companies do that. So many. Well, they were nearing bankruptcy. They were in trouble. Sales dying, blah, blah, blah. In steps the private equity firm. Here's how we're going to do this. We're going to get you back on track, okay? First thing we're going to do is we're going to get you $500 million. You're going to borrow. We'll make the arrangements. We're a financial intermediary. We'll get you the $500 million. Oh, you're going to get $400 million. We keep $100 million for our fees. Oh, and by the way, you're also going to give us a bunch of stock, too, to save you. Okay, we got that done. Okay, now we're going to cut off all of your American suppliers of your goods in your stores, and we're going to get that all from China. We've got our connections. We've got it all set up for you in China. We're going to outsource to another country. What we can't make in China, we'll get done in India. We've got all of the factories ready to go to start providing you with merchandise at lower prices. No problems whatsoever. And then, by the way, we're also going to, you know, take a seat on your board of directors. We've got a couple of them. We're going to get you back in shape. You're all good. And then what we're going to do is you're still going to be dying because you're still the same tired stores. And you're going to suddenly be slipping. But not before we make it very well known we have come into the rescue. We are bringing Sears back. And guess what that's going to do to the price of Sears stock? It's going to bring it up like that. Then we're going to sell that stock that you gave us beneficially. And then all we'll have is debt in the company. And as it shows that your stores are still dying, well, you can't pay the interest payments on those loans. Okay, we got to take you into bankruptcy. We're going to liquidate your stores. I'm sorry. Go away, all you shareholders of Sears. Go away, you board of directors who got suckered into this. We own your stores now because we have the prior claim on the assets. And so what we now do is we just liquidate everything, and then we sell the core off to the next sucker company. You know that we have the stores of Sears, and we can get those into the deal for $700 million for you in loans. And the ball keeps going on and on. One company after another will fall victim to these private equity firms. And inside, what we call what we do in these, to design these financial products to get the suckers, we call that financial engineering. It's the hottest field in all of finance right now. It's mathematical, but at the end of the day, my God, your paychecks are just so good. And yes, you destroy lives. You wreck companies. You leave communities with shells, open dead stores and malls like there on Veterans Parkway here in Bloomington, like in Peoria, like in major cities all over the place. We did that. We feel bad about it, but, you know, a payday of $300-400 million, that's kind of nice, too, so we can sleep at night. That's what those guys do. They're financial intermediaries. They match desperate, dying companies with money, and then we take our piece in the middle here, a big chunk, and then we control when these companies die. We don't let them die until we've driven their stock price up through hype and promo, pump and dump, and we sell our stock at high prices. And then the news hits, oh, this company really does suck, you see. And so then eventually we just take them into bankruptcy because they can't pay our interest payments on the loans that we gave them. And then we kick out everyone and we take over. Staples is another one. A private equity firm, there are one that was prominently in the news about 11 years ago, was it? The Republican presidential candidate, Mitt Romney, was one of the principals of one of these private equity firms. They were responsible for the destruction of Staples, which was once, before your time, a vast, very popular office supply store. You know, that's what we do, and I hope you like it. But anyway, I have a quiz for you to take now, so, and then you're done for the day. That's all I have for you after.